I will call the remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committee and Policy Committee to order. Today is February 25th, 2021. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take the roll.
Hanson Rick is present. Wasilewicz, Amy.
Wasilewicz present.
Wasilewicz present. Heintzman, Josh.
Present.
Heintzman present. Acomb, Patty.
Acomb present.
Acomb present. Ackland, Susan.
Ackland present.
Ackland present. Backer, Jeff. Backer, Jeff. Beckerfin, Jamie.
Present.
Beckerfin present. Ackland, Rob.
Present.
Ackland present. Fisher, Peter.
Fisher present.
Fisher present. Green, Steve.
Here.
Green present. I go Spencer.
Present.
I go present. Jordan Sydney. Jordan Sydney. Keeler Heather.
Keeler present.
Keeler present. Lee Fu.
Lee present.
Lee present. Lippert Todd.
Lippert present.
Lippert present. Lewick Dale.
Lewick present.
Lewick present. Morrison Kelly.
Morrison present.
Morrison present. Nelson Nathan.
Nelson present.
Nelson present. Backer Jeff. Backer Jeff. Jordan Sydney. Jordan Sydney. All right, a quorum is present.
Thank you, Adam. And before we do the minutes, it has been noted that there was some technical difficulty in getting our minutes up on the committee website. Adam, has that been resolved or it's being worked on?
It has not been resolved yet, but I have a feeling it's just because of the type of document that's been getting sent in. It'll get resolved very shortly.
Thank you. The next item on the agenda is the minutes for Tuesday, February 23rd. Representative Eklund, have you looked at the minutes?
I'll move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Eklund moves the minutes for February 23rd, 2021. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, ayes have it. Representative Backer, did you want to discuss the minutes, or you were just noting that you were here?
I am noting I'm here. Thank you, Chair.
Members, we have a full agenda today, and we have some members that are double booked in other committees. So we're moving around a little bit on the agenda. We also have a lot of testimony that has been provided in writing. The first bill we're going to take up is House File 990 by Representative Marquardt, the Soil and Water Conservation District Supervisor Compensation. Is Representative Marquardt here?
I am, Mr. Chair.
I will move that House File 990 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Marquardt, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Chair Hansen and members, and for moving this up into the agenda. So what this bill does, it raises the per diem cap for Soil and Water Conservation District supervisors from $75 to $125. So Soil and Water Conservation District supervisors are elected for four-year terms. It's staggered. This cap has not been raised since 2003. In fact, in 2019, we raised the watershed district supervisors per diem up to $125. So this would be permissive language. It would not require them to go to 125, but they could, if they wanted to, go up to that amount. Right now, that's the only compensation that members get other than mileage and travel. And I will say that as the years have gone by, the responsibility for these soil and water conservation districts have increased with buffer law legislation. I was just looking at the agenda of the Clay Soil and Water Board, and they're dealing with CREP, AIS, pollinators, cover crop, all sorts of things. So these soil, water, and conservation districts came about first in 1937 during the Dust Bowl to try to encourage better farming practices and techniques and so forth. So Members, I do have one testifier with me, and I can either take questions then, or we could go to a testifier, Mr. Chair.
Why don't we get the testifier done, and then we'll go to Representative Green.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that would be Sheila Vanney.
Ms. Vanney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Marquardt, for carrying House File 990. I think you really covered the basics of what we're seeking here, and I would be happy to be available for any questions and appreciate your all's consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Green, either to the testifier or Chair Marquardt.
Chair Marquardt, Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Marquardt, does anybody oppose this bill that you just come about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I'm not aware. I haven't received any notification of any opposition.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Marquardt. I think that this is going to surprise you. I think this is a good bill. I don't know of too many committees out there right now that are still at $75. Townships are probably way below that, but they can deal with that. So I do support this bill, and I encourage people to vote for it.
I'm sure Representative Marquardt is looking for co-authors to this bill. Representative Green, you could sign on. Any other discussion? Representative Marquardt, any closing remarks?
No, Mr. Chair, just thank you so much for moving me up. And I think this is kind of long overdue and would be much appreciated by a group that does a lot in our areas. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Ask for your support.
I will renew my motion that House File 990 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Next up will be House File 1255. By me. So Vice Chair Wozlawick, do you want to take the reins? And I will pull up the bill here.
All right. Thanks, Chair Hansen. I will take up the gavel. And Chair Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I will move that House File 1255 be recommended to be re-referred to the Climate and Energy Finance Policy Committee.
Chair Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Vice Chair. This House File 1255 is a bill that authorizes a power purchase agreement between District Energy and Xcel. Members, this has been a topic that's been discussed for quite some time. This provides the authority for that power purchase agreement. It's been worked out by the parties. I think somebody may ask, why is this here in front of Environment? And if you think back a couple weeks, we had that long discussion about Emerald Ash Borer and ash trees. And when you look at the bill, you will see discussion about ash trees and emerald ash borer. So it has some definitions. It defines emerald ash borer, and it also defines ash. And then it talks about some of the concerns the committee's had with movement of ash trees, trying to make sure that we're not moving the disease. All that's spelled out in this agreement, which I think is a very good step. I have a number of testifiers that are here who can describe the bill, and I would move to them.
All right. First on the list today is Ken Smith. If Mr. Smith, if you would just identify yourself for the record.
Let me share my screen. I trust you can see that?
Yep.
Okay, great. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ken Smith, and I'm the President and CEO of Evergreen Energy and District Energy St. Paul. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to HF 1255. Since 2003, our company has been helping to manage tree waste by using it as a biomass fuel to generate renewable electricity that's sold to Xcel and heat to District Energy St. Paul that is used to heat approximately 200 buildings in the downtown St. Paul area, including the Capitol Complex. One of the key reasons that a biomass-fired combined heat and power plant was planned to next to District Energy in the 1990s was a response to the challenges that the region dealt with Dutch elm disease and the large volumes of tree waste that it produced, much of which ended up being open burned. The plan for a modern combined heat and power plant came forward and located that plant next to District Energy in St. Paul and downtown, and integrated into the hot water district energy system so the waste heat from power generation could be used to heat the community. The plant was purposely designed to use raw tree waste as a fuel, as a means to help solve this regional problem, and it also displaced coal that was a predominant fuel at District Energy at the time. The plant has now been in operation for 18 years and has been quite successful in managing the region's tree waste. Today, we manage approximately 265,000 tons annually and generate 153,000 megawatts of megawatt hours of renewable electricity that is sold to Xcel, and about 50% of all the heat energy needed to heat 32 million square feet of building space. To give an idea of how much tree waste that is, if it was all processed into wood chips, it would fill approximately 12,000 semis, which would extend end-to-end 150 miles or from the state capitol complex to Alexandria. Today, hundreds of businesses and dozens of communities depend upon this facility to manage tree waste, and particularly as emerald ash borer is in the process of killing ash trees. Since 2012, we experienced a significant increase in the amount of tree waste we're managing. Where EAB is present, the volumes we deal with in the seven county metro area have doubled since 2012, and that's the challenge that brings us here today and the need for this bill. Our PPA with Xcel expires at the end of 22, less than 2 years away, and without a new PPA, this facility would not be able to continue to operate and manage tree waste. From all of our discussions over the last several years, the agencies and the stakeholders in this space have agreed there's no viable plan B yet in place to manage that volume of tree waste if this facility shuts down, and frankly, we are out of time now. That is why we are seeking a two-year extension through the end of 2024, extending this operation, facility this operation for two more years with the conditions laid out in legislation provides that operational certainty to manage the region's tree waste while we together with state and other stakeholders determine alternative pathways and how best to pay for it. So this facility may not be a permanent solution, but it is a solution that is working today and provides a valuable bridge until the future, until longer term alternatives can be put in place. There are things in this bill related to the cost of energy, which is a reduction, and also that we would work together with Xcel on integration of electrification in the facility. Like Xcel, District Energy is committed to being carbon free by 2050, and so we're excited to work together with them on a project like that. We're pleased that the companion bill, SF 1047, is on the Senate floor already, and we are hopeful that this bill will join it in the House. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Next up, we have Rick Evans. Mr. Evans, if you would identify yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. I don't want to take up too much of your time. I will tell you that we're fully supportive of this bill. Some of you may know that this contract to purchase this energy, that the current contract arose out of the 1994 legislative session and the biomass mandate. As Mr. Smith indicated, that contract is coming to an end at the end of 2022. And the two companies have been working together over the last several years trying to figure out how best to make this transition once that contract is over. The legislation in front of you is the culmination of that, of those talks and those agreements. From Xcel Energy's point of view, there are some real advantages to this bill. It does continue our purchase of this energy for two additional years, but it is still at a price savings compared to the current contract. It's still a pretty high price, but it is a savings for our customers, and it is a necessary transition between the end of the last contract and the end of this new contract. Secondly, the bill makes clear that at the end of that 2 years, Xcel Energy no longer has an obligation to purchase energy from District Energy. But we wouldn't be prevented from doing so. And so we know that District Energy is going to use the next 4 years to find alternatives that will bring the price of their energy down and make that a competitive product for us if we decided to continue with a power purchase agreement. Finally, the bill puts, and this is what we're most excited about at Xcel Energy, it puts District Energy and Xcel Energy in a partnership to look at electrification of all or part of their system. This is a very complicated proposal. We have a lot of engineers jointly with the companies currently working on that. It will, of course, have to be approved by the Public Utilities Commission, but in this legislation, the two companies are committing to work together over the over the next 4 years to see if that can be accomplished. I'll end my testimony there and be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Next on the list, we have Greta Gauthier from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Ms. Gauthier, if you can identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize to the committee, but did not mean to sign up to testify for House File 1255, but rather for House File 1237.
All right.
Sorry about that.
No problem. We'll move on to the next testifier. Next on the list is Forrest Sire from the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Forrest Sire. I'm with the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, and I'm happy to be testifying again in front of the committee this week. I want to offer brief testimony in support of House File 1255. As this committee knows, emerald ash borer is a problem of gigantic proportions, threatening the health of every ash tree in Minnesota. As we continue to fight against EAB in Minnesota by replacing trees with diverse and climate-adapted species, wood waste will continue to be a growing issue for communities throughout the state. We will need creative solutions to fully address the problem, as well as ensure that our current capacity for tree waste disposal is maintained. In St. Paul, the cogeneration facility addressed in this bill plays a crucial role in the disposal of wood waste in the metro area and beyond. As my members have made clear to me, the continued operation of this facility is vital, and any legislation that ensures its continued viability is important. I'm happy to take any questions, and thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Sear. And I don't have anybody else on the list. We'll open it up if members have any questions at this time. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just want to point out that this is really a win-win-win situation with this bill and the fact that an agreement was reached. Many communities like mine in the Roseville area really depend on District Energy and the ability to bring wood waste there. And it's an added bonus that we can get energy to power things as well. So really glad that we're able to vote on this today. Thanks.
Any other member questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. So, Chair Hansen, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a good bill. It's an effort, as many things often are, of years of work and negotiation to get to this place. So I would ask for your support, and I would encourage all members to co-author this bill. It's pretty easy. You just add on. You could do it. I think Representative Becker-Finn already did during the meeting. So add on, and you can get your name added as a co-author today, and we will be moving it out to the Climate Committee. So I ask for your vote.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 1255 be recommended to be re-referred to the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll on the motion.
Hansen, Rick.
Hansen, Rick, aye.
Hansen, aye. Wasilewicz, Amy.
Wasilewicz, aye.
Wasilewicz, aye. Heinzelman, Josh.
Aye.
Heinzelman, aye. Akam, Patty.
Akam, aye.
Akam, aye. Ackland, Susan.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Backer, Jeff.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Becker, Finn, Jamie.
Aye.
Becker, Finn, aye. Ackland, Rob.
Aye.
Ackland, aye. Fisher, Peter.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Green, Steve.
Aye.
Green, aye. Igo, Spencer.
Igo, aye.
Igo, aye. Jordan, Sydney. Keeler, Heather.
Keeler, aye.
Keeler, aye. Lee, Fu. Lee, Fu. Lippert, Todd.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Lewick, Dale.
Luick, aye.
Luick, aye. Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Nelson, Nathan.
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Just to go back, Jordan, Sydney. Jordan, Sydney. Lee Fu. So that is 16 ayes and zero nays.
And with that, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to Climate and Energy Finance and Policy. Next up is House File 1237. Chair Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 1237 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee.
I understand that you also have an author's amendment, Chair Hansen. Do you want to move that amendment and explain it?
Yes. I would move, Madam Chair, I will move the A1 amendment. This adds the MPCA's wastewater overflow notification policy language and deletes the section related to PFAS and MRLA, as the committee already heard that bill.
Representative Hansen moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author wants. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, this and members, this is the MPCA policy bill, and I have Ms. Gauthier and Mr. Kadelka from the MPCA to walk through the bill, as well as some other testifiers.
Ms. Gauthier, if you want to identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Hi, good afternoon. I'm Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today and testify on House File 1237, which is our policy bill for this year. Madam Chair, this bill, as amended, has four components. Our fact sheets on each of these four components have been posted, so I'll direct members to those for more information. I'm going to walk through the four components in the order that they now appear in the bill as amended. And then I have Assistant Commissioners Kirk Kadelka and Katrina Kessler here to help with questions. So with that, Madam Chair, Section 1, which is embodied in the A1 amendment, is the MPCA's policy item that's meant to ensure public awareness of unplanned sewage discharges. So increasingly wet weather and extreme storms are overburdening the stormwater and wastewater systems in communities and contributing to statewide average of about 150 overflows each year. An overflow is what happens when the water is coming in so quickly that a municipality needs to either discharge the partially treated or untreated wastewater to the receiving surface water, because if they don't, it may back up into community members' homes or businesses, which is, of course, a public health risk that they can't take. So this unplanned release of untreated or partially treated wastewater is a growing problem in Minnesota. Part of the issue is aging infrastructure, but the more frequent and severe rainstorms are exacerbating the situation. Section 1 would allow the MPCA to require that municipalities must notify the public in the event of unplanned releases of partially treated or untreated wastewater. That way, downstream communities can make informed decisions because they would know that these releases are occurring. It's worth noting, Madam Chair and members, that at least 13 communities, including the two biggest cities in the state, Minneapolis and St. Paul, draw their drinking water from the surface waters in Minnesota. Madam Chair, we have been working with the cities to make this language more implementable. We had put together an amendment that is shorter, less detailed, and more flexible. Unfortunately, we did not get that amendment ready in time for this committee. Cities do recognize, of course, and want to solve this issue and work with us on that, and we want to work with them. So again, we have an amendment ready. It was not ready in time, but we will work with the author and we will continue working with cities to find language that cities can implement so that downstream communities have this important information. So, Madam Chair, that's the first component of the bill. The second component of the bill is dealing with technical updates to our electronic waste statutes. So this comprises sections 1 through 6 of the bill as it was introduced. So there are some technical changes, and they correct and update existing statute and areas that are unclear, outdated, or erroneous. So these changes include removing outdated language that no longer applies, updating definitions for some digital devices to include new technologies, and clarifying other parts of these statutes. The e-waste statutes were put in place 10 years ago now, and think of how technology has changed over that time. So a full list of the changes that we're making is included in the fact sheet that was posted yesterday, and all of them are technical in nature, Madam Chair. Be happy to go into them in detail in questions, but for now, I think I'll leave it at that. Implementing these technical changes will allow the e-waste statutes to adhere better to legislative intent and will allow them to be implemented more efficiently. That's the second part of the bill, Madam Chair. The third part of the bill is actually a bill from last year. It is the 2020 Land Policy Bill that the agency had. So the 2020 Land Policy Bill did get to the House floor last year, but unfortunately was held up in the Senate after the COVID-19 pandemic hit. So in that bill from last year, there were 3 main pieces, and all 3 of those are in House File 1237. They are sections 8, 9, 10, and 11. So, Madam Chair, very briefly, the Section 8, the provision in Section 8 relates to our Superfund program, and this is merely conformance with new federal guidance on how we should rank our Superfund projects for hazard. So every so often, the EPA updates their hazard ranking system that states must use, and they last updated it in 2018. Previous to that, it had not been updated since 1990. So rather, you will see in the repealer that we're deleting the language referring to the 1990 version. And instead of referring to the 2018 version, we would rather just say that the agency must use the most current hazard ranking system that has been approved by the US EPA to assess our Superfund sites. So that's the first item from last year's bill. The second item relates to part of our closed landfills program. So for those members who are new, the closed landfill program was created by the legislature in the 1990s when we were first requiring landfills to be lined. Previous to that, a lot of landfills were unlined. So there are 110 closed landfills statewide that have enrolled in the closed landfill program. When they enroll in that program, the state takes on the cleanup and the care and maintenance of those sites in perpetuity. And so in 2017, the legislature expanded or updated the closed landfill program language by adding a new category of closed landfills called priority qualified facilities. And this language in sections 9, 10, and 11 deals with these priority quality facilities and changes that are needed. So in 2017, we were, the priority qualified landfills category is intended for landfills where the landfill owner does not voluntarily come into the closed landfill program, but the landfill poses a risk to public health and the environment. And it gave the agency some new authorities for these types of closed landfills so that we could get access to the sites, get the information we need, and get a cleanup started. What we're doing in this bill is we're closing some loopholes from the 2017 law that that would have left taxpayer dollars vulnerable when there are cleanups at priority qualified facilities. So we can get into more detail about those, but basically it involves how we condemn the property and then how we come back and we want to put in a windfall lien so that the owner of a priority qualified landfill would not be able to make a profit off of the sale of that cleaned up land after the state has paid for the cleanup. So we're happy to go into more detail about that, but there is right now only one landfill that's in the qualified priority qualified facilities. It's located in the suburban South Metro. The third item from the 2020 bill, which is section 12 of this bill as introduced, is aimed at preventing potential contamination from another group of landfills that's even older. So this is a group of about 150 landfills across the state that are older landfills that are also closed, but they are not in the closed landfill program. I know there's a lot of landfills out there. The problem here is that it's not clear to people where these landfills, these old landfills, are located. And we've had some problems where they've been accidentally dug up. And then that creates a whole new issue of having to clean them up. So the language in Section 12 allows us to identify these old landfill sites through legally binding agreements that everyone agrees to. All parties must sign and agree. And so essentially what this does is make the legal tools from the Uniform Covenants Act available to the PCA's solid waste program. These tools are already used by our brownfields program to clean up Superfund and petroleum contamination sites. So this language will also ensure that future property owners are aware of where these sites are located and the precautions that may need to be taken around them. So that's the third item, Madam Chair, in our bill. And then the last item in House File 1237 is contained in Section 13. And this is language related to that came to us through our work around PFAS, but it applies to a broader category of contaminants. So this is language that gives limited authority to the MPCA to obtain information on the use of contaminants from potential sources of contamination when we have a contaminated site with data showing contamination levels. Madam Chair, understanding where the sources of pollution are is the first step towards cleaning up contaminated sites and protecting human health and the environment. So this section is not a blanket new requirement of all facilities. It gives the agency limited ability to seek and obtain information on the use of a contaminant only when there is a contaminated site and only for this purpose. Having this data, Madam Chair, will help us identify the sources of contamination quicker when we find a contaminated site. We'll also gain efficiencies in addressing the site, which means we will be reducing the length of time that people could potentially be exposed, and it will help prevent water, land, and air pollution. It's important to note that trade secrets would be protected as not public data under the Minnesota Data Practices Act. And so the MPCA would not share any information obtained with this limited authority that was a trade secret. Section 13 will be especially helpful in our work to address PFAS contamination. But again, to be clear, it applies to any contaminant, Madam Chair. So those are the four main pieces of this year's policy bill. Actually, three of them are new, and then one is the bill from last year that did not pass. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll conclude my walkthrough, and we will be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Gauthier. I do have Kirk Kadalka next on the list. I don't know if, since we just did the walkthrough, I don't know if he wants to say anything else or just be available to help answer questions.
Madam Chair, I think he's here for questions, so we would defer to your process of when you want to take questions.
All right, then we'll proceed with the folks on the list for testifying, and we'll take questions at the end. Next up is Tony Quillis. Mr. Quillis, if you can identify yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure you can hear me so I don't get Mr. Strohmeyer's heart rate up.
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tony Quillis, and I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And just like to start out that we would like to have further conversations with the author and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on sections 8 through 12. I think some of them, specifically 9 through 11, as Ms. Gauthier pointed out, are discussing one facility that's located in the southern metro area, but we just wanted to discuss the general applicability with the agency. And so I look forward to having conversations with them, Madam Chair, in that regards. I wanted to focus my comments on Section 13 that Ms. Gauthier just talked about and who this would apply to, Madam Chair, and how the words on the paper that I'm interpreting. First of all, Madam Chair, under Section 13 on page 13, if you look at lines 13.26 to 13.27, it's talking about anybody who's involved in manufacturing, distributing, using, or selling products. I interpret that as meaning retailers, the corner grocery store, if the corner hardware store, Madam Chair. Also, if you go on to page 14, it talks about the definition of a person. So it's not just a private industry, it's also any public industry, including any city, county, or state facility. And also under a supplier is anybody who provides goods or services that lead or are incorporated into a finished product. So now we've kind of identified who we're talking about here, public companies, cities, counties, state facilities, and any manufacturer, distributor that's using or selling products. So that's our world, if you will, of who's going to be affected by this. Madam Chair, then we go into subdivision 2, where the commissioner may take action if they detect or the commissioner has reason to believe. And detect is not defined, Madam Chair. It doesn't matter what level it's detected at. It could be a de minimis. It could be below health risk limits. And it's in no violation of a permit. But yet the agency is allowed to take action if they detect at any level and the commissioner has reason to believe. That starts us into subdivision 3, Madam Chair, that allows the agency to enter public or private property and then also request in writing any documents, papers, books, and other tangible items, as well as provide information on any supplier or anybody in the supply chain who is in the production of a commercial or consumer good. Ask for that information, and then they set the timeline, Madam Chair, on 15.24 to 15.28 on when that information has to be provided. Sometimes that might be a couple pieces of paper. Other times it might be volumes of three-ring binders, but they get to set the timeline on when that has to be provided, whether it's 24 hours, 48 hours, or a week. But that's not negotiated. They set the timeline. And if you don't meet it, then they go to district court to compel you to meet it and start to take or could take enforcement action. So I just, all that data, they set the timeline, and then they set the rules on whether they're going to go to court, do the enforcement action. And then, as Ms. Gauthier pointed out, in this on classifying data, the data obtained from this person under this section is public data until the city, county, or private facility then goes through and says, that's my sales figures, it's a production that's unique to me or proprietary information, then the agency can say, okay, we're going to make that private. Until you get to line 16.2, where it says, notwithstanding under other law to the contrary, data classified as private may be disclosed when relevant under any other proceedings in this section. So now all my proprietary information, my sales information that makes me unique and better than or different than my competitors has now become public. So, Madam Chair, those are my concerns. I look forward to working with the author and the agency as this bill moves through the process. And thank you for your time today, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Next up, we have Brian Martinson. If you want to identify yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Hello, Madam Chair and members. I'm Brian Martinson. I'm the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties, representing all of Minnesota's 87 counties. We are generally supportive of many of the provisions in this bill. My testimony will be largely reduced due to the amendment removing the original Section 7 regarding PFAS designation. However, I will point out there are six sections that address the e-waste program. These are mostly housekeeping provisions, and that while cleaning up the current language is well-intended, I would like to bring it to your attention that the program has done a good job of redirecting e-waste away from landfills and dump sites, but it was structured so that manufacturers would pay for the recycling of their products, and yet currently they only cover about 60% of the cost, and the rest of that tab is largely paid for by the counties. Changes in the design and diversity of electronics will further challenge this program as it's currently structured. So we look forward to bringing a proposal to you in the near future to reform this program. Finally, the landfill provisions in this bill are largely updating of tools for the agency to address issues in the environment already. We appreciate the agencies working with us on changes to the original language of Section 12 to ensure that all parties are in agreement when a covenant is put in place. And that concludes my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martinson. Last on the list for testifiers, I have Craig Johnson. Mr. Johnson, if you want to identify yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Our written testimony that was submitted was addressed by the A1 amendment. That section was removed, and it did exactly duplicate testimony I gave last week on that issue. Did have a secondary comment I wanted to make, though, on the A1 amendment, the notification requirements included in there. Rather than go into lots of details when the committee is tight on time, just want to be clear that the League of Minnesota Cities, Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, and wastewater operators are all working with the Pollution Control Agency on that language. The version that is currently in the bill is not something we feel works right. And just very briefly, the notification requirement is immediate. That often is occurring during a natural disaster or other urgency at the infrastructure site. And the public works staff are really needed for that, not driving around to post notices on beaches and things at that moment. So we'd like to work on that. We don't have access to all the properties listed. Private campgrounds, resorts, marinas, and neighboring community beaches and parks. We can't just have a city driving around posting public notices on those properties. We don't have the ability to do that. And secondly, there's no scope or scale involved with this. So it's going to be a permit issue. It's written into cities' permits, and it does not differentiate between a 5-gallon spill on an overland site and an ongoing larger issue into a surface water. So we think that there's a need for at least some sort of way that a facility will know if it has met the requirements of its permit with notifications. So we'll be continuing to work with the author and the agency on that. Very much appreciate having a couple of minutes to mention it on the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I don't have any other testifiers on my list. Do we have member questions at this point? I see Representative Heinzman has a question. Representative Heinzman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a lot of questions about this bill, and I'm quite honestly a little frustrated. I do see some things here that I believe make sense. I'm glad that we're seeing some adjustments to how we're defining some things, like the issue with PFAS. I think that's a step in the right direction. We're probably still going to have a lot of conversations about PFAS as a hazardous waste versus a toxic substance, but
I'm hoping that the commissioner could walk us through some of these things that Mr. Quillis brought up and I thought did a really good job helping to highlight some issues with definitions specifically, and then also some of the new authorities that MPCA is asking for in this bill. So I'd probably be centering around, at least to start, 14.21 with the definition of a person, and then trying to understand that would help us as we get to 15.25 and some of the power that MPCA is asking for above what they currently have. So maybe maybe Greta could walk through this, or Mr. Kadelka, either way. But there's definitely some question marks there. And if they could give us a more detailed understanding of why these changes need to be made, at least in the context in the the way you're describing it seems a little odd. And specifically, Greta, when you said that the language gives the agency limited authority, I have to say, I about spat out my gum sitting here reading this, because the broad authority that you're asking for is really concerning. And I hope it doesn't stay in the bill, because if it does, it's going to go nowhere. I don't think that this language can go forward. It may leave this committee, but I don't think it's going to become law. And if you could explain a few of those concerns relative to those sections I mentioned, that would be a good starting point. Thank you.
Ms. Gauthier or Mr. Kradelka, not sure when to start.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative Heisman, thank you for the questions. And Mr. Quillis, sure, I'm happy to work through some of that. I would, if it would be all right, like to bring Mr. Kadelka up as well, as this is more his area. But my understanding is that the way this statute is written and its placement in the chapter is a limited authority. It is not a blanket authority that we can, that would be something that could be done at any time. There has to be a contaminated site. But I'll turn it over to Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Kadelka, you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And just to elaborate a little bit more on Greta and why this is a more targeted surgical approach at getting information, many states have broad reporting requirements for products to report on a list of chemicals from every type of product. And so that has been something that the legislature has discussed before, to be able to get this information to help make policy decisions or work on pollution prevention activities, or as Greta mentioned, follow up when we may have contaminants in the environment or natural resources, or picking it up in biomonitoring through the Department of Health. So instead of that broad category and have everyone report on, say, PFAS that may be in their products and that, what we're looking to do is use authority when we have information showing it's showing up in someone's body or in the natural environment. And if we start tracing it back to certain potential sources, we then are able to target it there and address it. In terms of a couple of the questions there, the person definition should be the same definition that we use for person in the rest of our statutes and the like, and we just here have it printed out along with all the other definitions. If it is different, we can work to change that. It is not our intent. Many statutes, not only MPCAs and others, use the definition of person, and it is broad in that way. And it just, again, there to aid the reader as they go through this. So the question was, you know, what type of situations or why would the agency need to do this? And I want to give a couple examples of where we do need to be able to look only at a specific source.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was my question, and my question was centered around asking you to define these particular sections. So that was not my question. I just want to clarify that. I needed to understand why. For example, in line 14.29, the commissioner detects a contaminant, but there's no parameters defining what that level of detection is. That's just an example. So I was hoping you could walk through a number of those questions that Mr. Quillis brought forward, just clarifying my question. It seemed to be a misunderstanding. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Kadalka.
Madam Chair and committee members, I apologize. I misunderstood the question then. The idea here on the lines that were mentioned under agency action and detection of chemicals or compounds or contaminants is that we're not able to list through here all the contaminants or chemicals that are out there. And in many cases, these are new or emerging contaminants that we're trying to figure out what is the issue, what is the driver of something that we may not at this point have a health risk value for, but see that it's causing problems in humans, and we're trying to backtrack and follow it up. So this helps us be able to build that chain of what is a cause of an issue to be able to see what can be done to correct it. And so that's why there's not a specific reference to an amount or that, is because at some points we may not know what that amount is that may have a direct health risk. This really is looking at more so emerging contaminants where we have little information on the necessarily some of the impacts, and they're still trying to piece together the puzzle. That's why this is targeted towards that. Madam Chair and committee, just to make sure I clarify and understand the question, I believe Mr. Quillis's question is, how is this different than the existing authority and why those other authorities did not work? And if that's the question, I can update a little bit more on some examples where we have seen our existing authority does not work and explain how this would fill that gap. But I want to make sure I'm answering the questions.
I see Representative Heinzman nodding, so I think that would be a good thing to explain, Mr. Kadalka.
Sure. Thank you. So one of our examples is when we were following up with formaldehyde being found in children's shampoo. Our agency ourselves did not have the authorities to move forward on it. We had to partner with our sister agency, the Department of Commerce, to try to get information using their Safe Toys Act and other pieces. In that case there, we got very spotty responses and did not get information back from distributors or manufacturers or retailers. And our goal is to try to be able to track down who has the information and move forward in that regard. So in that case, the Safe Toys Act and that is really charged towards children's product, and we were able to use it in the case of children's shampoo. But if we're dealing with PFAS, say in packaging or a product or an industrial chemical, and we go to the company and they say, well, you know, we use these products, but we don't know if PFAS is in there. What we want to be able to do is go to that next chain in the supply line and ask that question to help that manufacturer understand that, and for us to track down what is the actual root of the problem so that any policy or individual response can be targeted to where the issue isn't and we don't create a broad characterization. This is something that other states have also seen problems with when dealing with PFAS and getting information, for instance, in chemicals being used in facilities, seeing PFAS outside of facility, but then trying to pinpoint what it is to be able to make that change. You know, one of the things as we talk about waste streams, whether it's a wastewater plant or a landfill, is that's coming to them. They're not sure where, and if we can pin back to a source, we get a building or some group of people, we can start then getting information on what's in there that might have the PFAS to help the company stop using it and stop creating that problem down the stream. Now, Assistant Commissioner Gauthier mentioned, we're very happy to talk with Mr. Quillis from the chamber to hone the language to be able to get to those goals. But given that there's a long line sometimes of knowing where this might be a chemical or where in the process, that's why there's the breadth of, as the representative and Mr. Quillis asked, why do we have retailers, suppliers listed? Because at this point, we don't know where that would be in all times, but would want the authority to be able to make that question asked, whether it's in the supply chain, the production or sale that the chemical such as PFAS is showing up.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, and I may have more questions, but I see that there's a few others. My comment would just be, as we're looking at the issues that have been laid out through the testimony of a number of folks, and then also as I'm trying to get a better idea what some of these things mean and why we're expanding so massively the authority of MPCA, I appreciate the places where you're providing extra information. I guess maybe that's how you're characterizing it, Assistant Commissioner, as it relates, say, for example, to the definition of a person. But when it comes to trying to get a definition or a threshold, at the very least, an idea of what is going to rise to the point where MPCA is going to make a decision that, okay, we have now detected a contaminant and that requires legal or MPCA action. I hope people at home are looking at this closely and thinking about how that may affect them and their business or their occupation and understand what I'm driving at, because I think that in the end, we're all agreed. We do not want to see polluted water. We do not want to see ground contaminated with chemicals or other materials. We agree on that. The question is, if we're going to define person to the extent that we did in this section, starting in 14.21 down to 14.25, why can't we define what it means to detect a contaminant? And I understand that may be difficult as it relates to many different contaminants, but there has got to be some guardrails. Otherwise, we're going to have a serious problem with people who have decided, I've detected a trace amount of fill-in-the-blank contaminant, and all of a sudden, we may be talking about some serious implications, and it could be a ski shop for all I know. I'm just providing a hypothetical. But that's just my concern there. I'm glad to hear, Assistant Commissioner, that you're looking to work with the groups and number of others to try and narrow this or at least try to get some broader definition. So that's my comment, and then I'll leave time for others.
All right, I see. I saw Representative Lewick's hand next. Representative Lewick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess this would be a question for either Assistant Commissioners. Have you specifically looked at a third-party entity here to kind of referee? You know, our county sheriffs are responsible for the personal safety of the entire community. But they don't just get to ramble through people's backyards, go into their businesses. They have to show legitimate probable cause to a third party before they can just literally have unfettered, and even that's not unfettered access. I'm just telling you, from my perspective, the agency needs to take a real gut check on what you're trying to do here, because it looks to me like this would be like giving the local law enforcement folks total unfettered access with no third party to referee as to whether this is really a violation of property and personal rights. So, I mean, have you considered a third completely independent entity, probably a district judge, where you had to come in and say, X, Y, Z, this is why we need to have access, this broad access. I mean, what's wrong with that approach?
I'm not sure who wants to take that. Ms. Gauthier?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. I'm going to ask Assistant Commissioner Kudelka to take that, please.
Mr. Kudelka?
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the question. You know, that's something that all of our work is reviewed and by the district courts or appeals courts, our actions. But if you're looking for something more specific, I think that's something as we have the conversations with others, you know, that's something we can look into. You know, there may, so thank you for the suggestion, and we'll be happy to include that in our further conversations with folks.
Thank you. Assistant Commissioner Kudelka and Madam Chair. I just want to narrow that a little bit. I'm talking about before you go kicking the door down or saying I've got authority to come in here and look at everything you've got behind this door. I would suggest that you need to have a district court judge literally grant you that kind of authority that all of our law enforcement people have to have if they don't have eyes on the problem. They need a warrant from a third party that justifies that potential invasion of personal privacy. So I mean, I suggest that you better back up and take a hard look at this, because if you want to go in that route, this is a good way to force the legislature to do that. And so be careful what you ask for, because I just see this as a huge overstep on the commissioner's ability to literally totally unfettered. But let me get on to the second element, and I don't know how you, this issue of wastewater treatment plants notifying everybody downstream if there's an overflow. How do you anticipate a small city in the upper Mississippi watershed that goes through a flooding event that lasts 6 to 8 weeks? You may have periodic overflows. You may have long-term ones. Isn't there a place for the agency to get that initial notification they have to have based on their permit? And then the agency step in and work with everybody concerned downstream? It looks to me like you ought to throw this A1 amendment out too, because can't the agency do better than that? Isn't that a point where the agency can step up and say, okay, let me look at this, and you look at the big picture, and then you work with all the other entities? Why can't we take that approach?
Ms. Gauthier?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if Assistant Commissioner Kessler is in the hearing.
Yes, I'm here.
There
yep,
she is.
Ms. Kessler.
Chair Wozelik and Representative, thanks for the question. And I think currently how this works is when there is a untreated or partially treated release of wastewater, there is a requirement to notify the state, but there is no requirement to notify anyone else. And to your question, we could ask for additional resources if we were going to look downstream in each of these 200 plus cases that occurred each year and do that notification. But I do think that it's important to think about who's closest to the users and who might have a good understanding of what is the appropriate notification in any one location. I think it's not going to be the same in every case, and I think we're committed to working with the League of Minnesota Cities and other communities on this to make sure that one size doesn't fit all, because a community that has one official employee versus a community that has hundreds of thousands of people have different abilities and different volumes of wastewater that they discharge. So rather than prescribe one solution for everybody, I think we're looking to work with people to make sense of what does a release of one day or over the span of multiple days or over a periodic flooding situation look like. And those are the types of details that I think we want to make sure we don't end up being too prescriptive on, but work with the communities in a way that makes sense for them.
Chair, thank you for that answer. And I would suggest that you probably need to go back to the drawing board, because I'll give you a general example. If you get up into Aiken County, Crow Wing County, we've got a number of small wastewater treatment plants located at a number of cities, all of them in that upper Mississippi watershed. Do you expect them to run down and start posting signs in St. Paul? Because your language literally implies that. Also, you're exactly right. One employee literally that runs that plant with maybe a couple other, you know, part-time or properly qualified so that they've got some flexibility there. This is a role, you know, and I'll one more comment. This is a role where MPCA could be really working the big picture on behalf of the citizens, rather than doing stuff like burning up FTEs and energy on the California cars thing. you know, this is where you can step in when we get a big flooding event, whether it's a quick rain or it's something that lasts for 6 weeks, and look at that big scope, because you've got the expertise to bring resources in to start testing water, start looking and predicting. Some gentleman or lady that's running that plant, that's just not in their job definition to start running around doing what even this A1 thing. So I hope you really take a hard look at that and go back and look at what you can do in the agency. And if that means giving up some of these things that you want to do on a broad level and rulemaking, that's fine. It's time to look at, because we deal with these major floods up in our part of Minnesota, and Corps of Engineers is mandated by the Upper Mississippi management approach with the dams and everything. So we live with this. And like you say, none of this language looks like it's appropriate for our part of Minnesota. Anyway, that's all I'll say. Thank you.
Chair Hansen, did you have something you wanted to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I find this discussion curious because what I think I'm hearing is that the PCA should take more responsibility, but they shouldn't have more authority. More responsibility, but less authority. And it would seem that, and no discussion about funding in that. So if you're going to have, you know, that the PCA should do this, the PCA should do that, the PCA should do this, and the responsibility, it would seem that there needs to be authority. And the charter of the MPCA is to protect the environment. And so we have, through both parties, years of neglect in updating requirements, authorities, responsibilities. It's a new day in 2021, and I'm hopeful that we recognize that and provide the tools that the agency needs for the next decades ahead, because the contaminants, what we're finding out is that many of these contaminants are much more impactful at smaller levels than we originally thought. But the legacy contaminants, we didn't think of the consequences when they were dumped. And now we do. And the impacts on them can be very great, and greater for certain populations than others. So trying to stay up on the curve and how do we actually protect people and the environment is going to take a thorough discussion and a look at how we make the agency work.
Members, we do have another bill on the agenda, so I'd like to wrap up discussion at 2:15 so we can move to that. We do have a few more questions we have to get to. Representative Thacker, if you all can, those with questions can try and make them brief.
Yeah, just two things. I would professionally disagree with the chair. That is not what Representative Lilly was talking about. I've been a mayor of a flood, and I know exactly what he's talking about. When you get such broad definitions, it really opens up to people like myself, who was mayor, during those scenarios and saying, hey, you did this type of contamination where we had no control over that. Again, it's how words matter down here. Words matter up in northern Minnesota. Words matter in western Minnesota. And these words are way too broad. You know, MPCA out in my neck of the woods, and I mean this respectfully, but I have to share it, is a four-letter word. It's not a positive word because a lot of locals want to do right. We want to protect the environment. But when you have someone that comes out from St. Paul that doesn't have the necessary background of what's been done in the past, who's more of an authoritative approach instead of a cooperative approach, that is what Representative Lulick is referring to. And so I respectfully disagree with the chair. I think he's not on the same page that what Representative Lulick was talking about. My question, I have one question, and I don't know which commissioner wants to do this. When you were putting this language together, who did you shop this out to? Who looked at this language before you put this in the bill? If you could help me with that.
Representative Backer, are you talking about the language about the notification or some other language? Just so we.
I'm just talking about in general with this language in the bill. Who did they go shopping around? Who did you? What stakeholders were involved with this language per se? Who helped put it together? Lack of to make it real simple.
Ms. Gauthier or Mr. Kadoka?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your question, Representative Backer. So we have worked with on all four parts of the bill. We have worked with many different stakeholders on the language. I would say that I can defer to Ms. Kessler, but I know that since session started, we've had numerous discussions with municipal groups about the overflow issue. I know that we have also had discussions about some of the PFAS items. We just finished a PFAS blueprint the agency did, and we are and have been talking with a lot of different folks about how do we get our arms around this big issue of PFAS. And I know you understand it because of your background, but you know, we're trying to figure out how do we get our arms around it. And Mr. Chairman, I will say that, you know, we may not have been able to, I don't know what you mean when you say, who did we shop this around to? Because we started talking to people about it after the language came to the legislature or the session started. Prior to that, we were still backed up in the revisor's office and still working on some things. So, as you know, everything got slowed down this year due to COVID-19, but we are making every effort to reach out and talk with people and find out what are their concerns and so forth. And we have met with many folks about these provisions and other provisions that we are bringing forward this year.
Representative Backer, was that your question or did you
have a question? I think we're fair. My concern is you maybe have, and I appreciate you sharing that. The broad language, I know the municipalities that I represent, the ag groups that I represent, would not be happy with the definition of a contaminant. What is a contaminant? You know, it's just a very broad, and that's my concern when you have, instead of being a partner, it's an authoritative type of thing. Just like Representative Lewis talked about, as an EMP, I work with law enforcement, and they have to make sure that they get the warrant before they can go in. So that's my concern. I do appreciate your comments, and thank you for your time.
Representative Green, you're next on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say, just to answer a couple of the comments that have already been made, I would say that, you know, the comments that first of all, that you reached out to the stakeholders, it didn't sound like that when we heard testimony from the city or the chamber. So that's disturbing. The other comment that was made about updating antiquated rules, this bill goes far beyond updating rules. I started reading the bill and I had problems with it from the start. And by the time I got to Section 13 and read through that, I almost forgot about the rest of the bill because the authority that's being given just in Section 13 alone is so disturbing that I don't know if I have enough time to talk about it all. I had a series of questions on Section 13, but thankfully for the committee, and thanks to Mr. Quillis, he answered every one of them. So I hope people were paying attention to his testimony. It was very revealing, and I was glad to see it. But the other thing is, you said that you wanted to work with communities on the language in the bill. Why didn't you work with communities before you drafted this language? They should have been involved in this right from the start to the finish. And it does not sound like they were. And should this language go forward and become law, I believe that you will be looking at lawsuits all across this state, because this is a clear violation of constitutional rights. It can't be interpreted any other way. And because my questions were answered, I'm going to leave you with the fact that we in government, as I've been saying forever, are supposed to be looking out for the freedoms. When we raise our hand and we swear that we're going to uphold our Constitution, that's what we're supposed to be doing. And this flies directly in the face of that. This isn't protecting anyone. This is violation of our rights here in this country and in this state. And so I hope you'll consider this and just take this bill off and go back, talk to the stakeholders, talk to the cities, talk to the chamber, and go out and talk to people in the real world and ask them what they think about this and where they think this is leading. Thank you.
All right. Representative Loke and Henspin, you have already had a chance to ask a question, so I'm going to go to Representative Becker-Finn, and then we do have to move on to the next bill on the agenda. It does sound like the MPCA is working with the chamber and the cities and counties on this, so I would hope that folks would contact them and reach out with concerns so that they can incorporate those concerns into that discussion. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to make clear that we as legislators, we don't represent ag groups. We don't represent stakeholders. We don't represent the chamber. We represent the people of Minnesota. And, the MPCA's job is to protect and improve the environment and human health. And I think it's important that we all remember that. Thank you.
All right, Representative Hansen, I know we have further questions, but we do have to move on to the next bill. Representative Hansen, do you have any closing comments?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen, we need to move on to the next bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen, do you have any closing remarks?
I renew my motion that House File 1237, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 1237, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. The clerk will take the roll on the motion.
Hansen, Rick.
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Wasilewicz, Amy.
Wasilewicz, aye.
Wasilewicz, aye. Heinzelman, Josh.
No.
Heinzelman, no. Acomb, Patty.
Acomb, yes.
Acomb, aye. Ackland, Susan.
Ackland, no.
Ackland, no. Backer, Jeff.
No, but I'm really concerned that we had other members with questions and they weren't addressed. This precedent is getting very disturbing in this committee. And I did send a letter to the chair that has not been acknowledged or the speaker. This is getting very disturbing. We would not treat the other side like this, but a no.
Becker, no. Becker-Finn, Jamie.
Aye.
Becker-Finn, aye. Eklund, Rob.
Aye.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Fisher, Peter.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Green, Steve. Green,
no.
Steve, no. I go, Spencer.
I go, no.
I go, no. Jordan, Sydney.
Jordan, aye.
Jordan, aye. Keeler, Heather.
Keeler, aye.
Keeler, aye. Lee, Fu.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Lippert, Todd.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Luick, Dale.
Loic really appreciates the opportunity to at least be allowed to vote. No.
Loic, no. Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Nelson, Nathan.
Nelson, no.
Nelson, no. So that is 11 ayes and 7 nays.
The motion prevails, and House File 1237 is on its way to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. I will turn the gavel back over to Chair Hansen.
You're muted, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Madam Chair, thank you. I will go to Representative Heinzman after I get the bill in front of us. Representative Heinzman. Representative Jordan, will you move that House File 1426 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jordan also has an author's amendment. Representative Jordan, will you move the A21-0042 amendment and explain it briefly?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move my amendment. This amendment establishes 6 cents per square foot of carpeting sold as a stewardship assessment. It requires manufacturers to submit reports based on their progress.
it deletes the name of specific counties and specifies the population instead. It allows counties to opt into the carpet stewardship program if they're not required to enroll if they so choose. And finally, this amendment is a technical amendment that clears up typos, misordering of numbers, and date errors.
Thank you. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope that people at home are watching, and I am going to speak to the process for a moment. I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair. It wasn't that long ago that Republicans were in the majority and Democrats were in the minority, and I heard lots and lots of speeches about the process and about how things were done and about bills not being given enough time, and members had questions, and maybe there were valid concerns, maybe there weren't, maybe that's a judgment. But I will say that when members continue to have questions, I think it would make sense to allow the minority to have a chance to get those questions answered and to give the minority the opportunity to get this bill thoroughly vetted before we're told we have to vote at a certain time, and that's the beginning and the end of it. This Zoom process is incredibly difficult for people to testify, especially in Greater Minnesota when internet isn't easily accessible for testifiers to be able to contribute to the process here in St. Paul. And so I think it's incumbent upon the majority to provide the minority that chance, even if it means taking more time at a different date. We can do that, Mr. Chair, if that's what it takes. We are willing to do that. And instead of just pushing a bill through and saying the time is up, boom, that's it. And, you know, eventually the roles will be reversed. And I hope that people remember the challenges that we face through this process. And I hope that going forward, this committee can operate in a way that allows that chance for everybody to be heard. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Heinzman. We appreciate your comments. I think that Vice Chair Wozlik was correct. She had actually given extra time than what she had indicated would be there to provide leeway. She went through all the representatives who had previously spoken, and we do have to get things done. We have been able to have a hearing tomorrow, and we have another Friday, but that's it. We can't go into the evening, and you and I both know we've tried in the past when we've extended to go into the evening. We don't have that option with us. Representative Heinzman, I would like to get the amendment on so that Ms. Jordan and that those people who did testify to try to get them through this next bill, the bill we're on is going to be laid over. It is not moving out. So if we could provide those testifiers the opportunity and to get the bill in the shape the author would like, we haven't voted on the amendment. Representative Jordan, to the A1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I just described it, and I ask for member support to get the bill in the shape that I would like to see it in.
All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Ayes have it on a divided vote. To the Representative Jordan, to your bill as amended with the testifiers, if the testifiers could move through quickly, that would be helpful. Doug Mankosh, CEO, Rise Technologies, Mankato.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Doug Mankosh. I'm sorry?
Do you need me to describe the bill before testifiers go through, or would you like to proceed straight to testimony?
I think we're going to run to the testifiers since they've made the time. So,
thank you, Mr.
Sorry
Chair.
About that. Mr. Mankosh.
Thank you. I'm Doug Mankosh. I'm the CEO and founder of Rise Composite Technologies, located in Mankato, Minnesota. I'm here to encourage the development of a carpet stewardship program in the state of Minnesota. We have developed over the past 16 years commercialized a patented technology to use post-consumer carpet waste to create sustainable long-term building materials. Particularly producing in Mankato today is exterior siding, exterior trim products, and exterior decking products. These are truly circular economy products. We take a difficult waste stream in carpet discards and we liberate the fibers and various constituents of it and turn them into high value added products that have great opportunity to improve the performance of outdoor building materials. Our products are capable of functioning in an industry where hundreds of millions of pounds and billions of pounds of raw materials are consumed. It gives us an opportunity to make a substantial reduction to the landfill waste streams, particularly those presented by carpet fiber and carpet discards. Currently, this type of program is operating in the state of California for several years. It's providing a recycling rate of 20% as opposed to an average of 1% around the rest of the nation. They also have bills introduced both in the state of Illinois and the state of New York currently. The stewardship program requires financial support from the industry to operate. The costs to the industry have to be fair, but they also have to be adequate. The cost of collecting the bulky product is difficult and high. The cost to destruct a very, very durable and tough product is expensive, and it also substitutes in very competitive product markets. Minnesota has a very unique opportunity over most of the other states. RISE's volume just in its Mankato plant is enough to consume the complete carpet discards of the state of Minnesota by itself. We are unique technologically, and we present a unique opportunity for the state of Minnesota. As we operate today, we actually rail ship carpet fiber in from the state of California and produce in Mankato. And we will continue to do that until we have other sourcing available to us, and hopefully in this state. We have invested about $40 million in the plant in Mankato, all private money, none of it requested from the state or local governments, to develop the technology and to retool an existing facility that was there to do provide our technology and operating platform. We employ on one shift today about 30 people, have just come into operation after a two-year retooling to our current product set, and we employ over 100 people in the next 2 years at that facility. We are prepared to invest in a recycling operation in Minnesota if the stewardship program is enacted and adequate, and further grow our footprint in the state. We'd like to assist you in resolving this landfill issue and solid waste issue and feel we have a unique technology that is able to use all types of face fibers from carpet and is not limited to only a certain percentage of it. I think we can present you a very good opportunity. We certainly invested heavily with the intent to be successful, and we look forward to working with you in this program to see if we can complete the effort in Mankato. Thank you very much.
Thank you. For the other testifiers, we have 1 minute each. We've got the ability to go a couple minutes over. So then we'll go back to Representative Jordan. So Mr. Thomas, then Ms. Stowe, then Commissioner Reinhart, and then Mr. Martinson, but very quickly, and I will have you on the timer.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name's Steve Thomas. I'm the founder of Better Futures Minnesota, and now I'm a consultant with that nonprofit focused on starting new businesses that create jobs by diverting waste from the landfill. You may be familiar with our deconstruction work and sales of used building materials. Over the past 2 years, this work, funded in large part by the Environmental Trust Fund, has created jobs for over 200 formerly incarcerated, mostly black men in the Twin Cities. And we now have a pilot up in Becker County where we have staff diverting waste from their transfer station. I'm pleased to testify in full support of House File 1426. Carpet stewardship and stewardship policies in general are valuable tools for creating new local businesses and local jobs for unemployed and underemployed people statewide. We see value in the used materials that are currently labeled as waste, and we see that public policy can level the playing field and help build new markets and businesses to divert much of this waste, like Thank used you. Carpeting.
Thank you. Ms. Stowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jen Stowe. I'm with the Carpet and Rug Institute. We are the trade association that represents the carpet manufacturers in the United States. The bill was just introduced on Monday, so we're really still trying to figure it out. It's a very different approach from what we've seen in California, and that is the only state that actually has carpet stewardship legislation in place so far. And after a decade, California is still a work in progress. This bill has unrealistic goals and other aspects that have us very concerned about this proposal working in Minnesota. And so for the record, we are opposed to this legislation. Thank you for your time.
Commissioner Reinhart. Commissioner Reinhart. Mr. Martinson. Mr. Martinson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Martinson. I'm the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties and with the Solid Waste Administrators. We are supportive of product stewardship initiatives and are currently reviewing this language. Product stewardship can be a valuable tool in the management of challenging waste streams, and we look forward to working with the author and the stakeholders on this proposal. Thank you.
Commissioner Reinhart.
Thank you. I'm Ramsey County Commissioner Reinhart, and I'm chair of the Partnership on Waste and Energy, and the partnership strongly supports producer-led product stewardship efforts to reduce life cycle impacts of products and managed materials, build sustainable circular economy. House File 842 is a carpet product stewardship approach, which we favor. It will create a broad stakeholder partnership and use products that would otherwise be landfill, jobs, economic growth, which you just heard, and reduce operational challenges in the processing of facilities and harmful greenhouse gases. We would encourage adding provisions to the carpet stewardship effort outlined in a letter of support that you have. And we priority for us is fully reimbursing local governments. Thank you. We look forward to working with you.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is important because we have simply put a waste problem here in Minnesota, and carpets are a major part of that. 86,000 tons of carpeting is disposed of in Minnesota every year. It's bulky and difficult to recycle. As lawmakers, we have a responsibility to our constituents to address the high volume of carpet in our landfills and incinerators. So thank you for your time, Mr. Chair. And I don't know how much time is left, but I can try to do a bill walkthrough, or I can stand for any questions.
I think we are out of time. And I've had actual constituents ask me, what is the difference between laid over and laid on the table? So when a motion is made to lay something on the table, a motion has to be made to take it off the table if it has been laid on the table. When a bill is laid over, and often in committees we talk about laying a bill over, that means it's not dead, it continues to be alive, it's gonna be worked on. So when we're laying these bills over, they're still alive in our committee, there's gonna be work. You've heard input from the testifiers. I'm sure there are going to continue to be questions. What I will ask you, Representative Jordan, are you willing to work with other members of the committee, both Republicans and Democrats, to try to improve your bill?
Mr. Chair, I'm willing to work with anyone who wants to address our waste problem here in the state of Minnesota.
And the folks who testified, I think, can provide additional input, as well as people at home. And we can contact Representative Jordan as this bill continues to be worked on, as we will lay it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over, and we are adjourned.